Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneer Zalman Neufeld. In The New Freedom and the Radicals, Woodrow Wilson, Progressive Views of Radicalism and the Origins of Repressive Tolerance, published by Temple University Press in 2015, Jacob Kramer examines how progressivism emerged at a time of critical transformation in American life. Kramer presents a study of Wilsonian-era politics to convey an understanding of the progressives' views on radical America. Jacob Kramer is an associate professor of history at Borough of Manhattan Community College, and I'm so glad his book has brought him to our program. Welcome, Jacob.
Thank you, Zalman.
So to get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Well, I was a graduate student at Columbia University, and I was taking a labor history course, labor in the 20th century with Joshua Freeman. And I was kind of, I hadn't really been exposed to labor history before. And I was kind of surprised to discover the extent to which the market, you know, which I had been accustomed to thinking of as a more or less abstract concept, was kind of a historical formation, you know. The way that Professor Freeman taught the course was that wage labor, you know, was not the normal and typical condition of workers until the 20th century, really. And it was highly contested. You know, workers were not happy about this. And it was resisted, you know. And so the labor question, whether or not workers would be willing to accept the condition of wage labor and working in factories and so forth, was kind of the thematic through line of the course. And, you know, especially going into the beginning of the 20th century, going into World War I, there were groups that, you know, very explicitly contested the growth of wage labor, such as the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a revolutionary labor union, a syndicalist labor union, which sought to overthrow capitalism with a general strike of all workers. But also within what are ordinarily thought of as more conservative labor unions, there was a lot of labor militancy, you know, within American Federation of Labor Unions. And, you know, even among workers that weren't necessarily organized into labor unions, there was a lot of strike activity, sometimes very violent, often requiring the use of military power to suppress these strikes. All of this to maintain, or really to create a market, you know, this market for labor and of other things, you know, transportation, rail networks, you know, coal, all these basic things needed to make the economy go. Until World War I, really. I mean, it's contested again after World War I, but during World War I, what happens is the state really kind of steps in and, you know, puts a stop, or at least throws its lot in on the side of business, you know, in many ways they help workers organize. But the idea of questioning whether or not there is going to be this market or whether or not there's going to be big business really is not up for grabs anymore. And I was very struck by that, in particular, the suppression that took place during the First World War of these radical labor unions and radical groups, not just the industrial workers of the world, but also socialists who, you know, were very viable political, who put forward a very viable political idea that was taken seriously by many, many people before the First World War, anarchists, all of whom were suppressed and you know, put in jail, really, or many of whom were put in jail or deported from the country. And so then, you know, I was really struck by that. And I wrote a paper about the IWW in particular for Josh Freeman for that course. And I kind of filed that away. But then I came to the Graduate Center for at the City University for my doctoral studies. And I took a course with Judith Stein, which was just the literature survey. And she introduced us to this concept put forward by David Plotkin of a kind of, you know, there's this, you're probably familiar with it, but there's this concept within cultural theory of hegemony, where there are certain sort of common sense ideas that most people accept. Those ideas are contested and they run into crises and so forth, but they change over time. And David Plotkin put forward this idea that the common sense, the hegemony, kind of shifts in the New Deal era to include union recognition, some regulation of business, like the Securities and Exchange Commission or Federal Deposit Insurance for banks and things like this, and some role for the government in providing for employment, unemployment insurance, employment when there is high unemployment. And he argued that the reason for that was this pressure from groups such as organized labor, in particular, the growth of organized labor and the pressure that they create, as well as other concentric circles within that of politicians and intellectuals, some business people sympathetic to it. And so then Joshua Freeman was at this time teaching at the Graduate Center where I was now a student. And I took a research seminar with him. And, you know, I said, I'm interested in the IWW. And I read this book by David Plotkin. And he said, oh, well, what you're interested in is what those groups thought about the IWW. And it was, actually. I wanted to know why this new hegemony was limited in the ways that it was, you know, why it was reformist, but it wasn't, you know, sort of challenging the foundations of the market or anything like this. I mean, it's not to understate the significance of it. And so then I wrote this research paper in that class about, and I kind of had to narrow it down as you ordinarily do with a research paper, but I looked at what progressives thought about the IWW during the war, specifically the suppression of the IWW during the war. And so I did a lot of, you know, looking at publications, the New Republic, primary documents to try to get at, you know, what their view was. And so then when it came time to write a dissertation, it became a larger project about progressives in general and how they thought about radicals in general, not just the IWW. I mean, I focused principally on working class radicalism, and not just during the war, but throughout the entire first 25 years of the 20th century. So the chapter about the war was one chapter. And part of that project was documenting how those views changed, because progressives did not always want to suppress the IWW at times, you know, or other radical groups, the socialists, or even anarchists, you know. At other times, progressives took a very sympathetic view of them. And it's not only that progressives took a very sympathetic view, you know, David Nassau, who's a cultural historian, was one of my first readers, you know, he said, well, the problem with this project is that you have the progressives over here and the radicals over here. Because in reality, progressives were at times themselves socialists, you know, Florence Kelly was a Marxist, you know, certainly before the First World War. Walter Lippmann was in the Socialist Party. So the sort of becoming progressives rather and progressivism becoming a different thing from radicalism or anti-capitalist radicalism is also part of the story, as I discovered, you know, and I was constantly reminded of this, you know, just don't, you know, one of my readers, Thomas Kessner, you know, he was, you know, constantly reminding me, you know, well, are you sure that, you know, and it, practically everybody I would talk to, you know, people would allege that, well, you know, it's at a, you know, a dinner party for my wife's job. You know, the president of the organization said, "Well, couldn't you just say the progressives were radicals?" I better come up with an answer for that. You know, so the basic answer was that, well, it depends on when. That's the argument that I make, is that it depends on when. Yes, at times that was true. But I don't think that was always true. I think it is possible to delineate a boundary that sometimes is quite porous, to use a term that was suggested to me by Eric Foner, and at times was, became solidified.
Right, right. So it's clear, I think listeners will already begin to understand, that what you're describing is a rather complex situation, that there are these two categories of progressives and radicals, and that these two categories, as you say, are porous, that they're not completely hermetically sealed off from each other, and that people from one group sometimes go to the other group or vice versa, or even if they stay in one group, they have political, ideological, or social contacts with people from the other group, and that the exact configuration of these two groups changes even during the relatively short period of time that you're looking at, the first 25 years of the 20th century. There's a lot of pieces moving around in terms of the exact political and ideological position of the people that you study.
Yeah, that's right. There's moving around, but I think it's not just in terms of who's in which group so much as that. It's partly I don't know what the word is for it. You know, it's partly that I don't reveal it's that I don't necessarily say from the beginning, you know, how people are going to end up. But, there are people that are ordinarily thought, and part of what I had to do, you know, for the project was name specifically who I was going to be focused on. Because in the original way that I thought of this, it was going to be more of sort of an overarching view with, you know, voices coming in and out here and there. But I was urged for the project to focus on a specific cast of characters. And the advantage of doing that is that I could pick people that are ordinarily and uncontroversially thought of as progressives. So, there aren't many people who are going to quibble that Jane Addams was a progressive. You know, Jane Addams, who was a settlement house worker, in some ways sort of like the first social worker, you know, she's, very sympathetic to, you know, the plight of the poor in the cities and so forth. But her views also change over time. So when I say it's not just a question of who's in which camp, I think the point, you know, what I'm trying to establish is that these folks that are ordinarily thought of as progressives, their views aren't always the same, you know, and I think the way that, if not historians, I think people more conventionally think of it is that, well, progressive means these five bullet points, you know, and that's progressivism.
Right. Well, speaking of which, if we could just take a moment here, I know that you're going to say that progressivism changes over time, and it's not always clear exactly what
it
means.
How did you know that?
Yeah. I read the book, but I'm not a mind reader here, folks. I just read the book, but I do want, for the sake of people who are not really familiar with this material, and especially because the term progressivism has changed over time, and that certainly in the contemporary a political context, people refer to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for instance, as a progressive, or Bernie Sanders or whatever as a progressive. So things could get quite confusing. So for the sake of clarity, could you tell our listeners a little bit about what you mean when you say progressive, when you use that term in discussing the early 20th century American political context?
Well, I get a little bit. You're warning me not to take up the entire time here. But, well, you know, it's true that progressive, what is considered progressive, changes over time, and nowadays progressive tends to mean sort of the leftward bound of the Democratic Party or of the liberal sort of political affiliation. Although I don't think that that's actually a bad way to think of it. It's just that what is, you know, the leftward bound of the sort of liberal political affiliation, or people who want to change things in the direction of greater, you know, sort of equity or something like this, is farther left today in many ways, although not in all ways, than it was at that time. You know, it's sort of harder in some ways to become progressive. I mean, especially when it comes to things like civil rights or something like that, or the environment. You know, the environment. I mean, the environment was an issue at that time, but you know, it's we face a different set of issues. You know, during the 30s, progressive tended to mean sympathetic to communism. You know, sort of pro-Soviet. But in the early 20th century, progressive tended to mean things. The basic idea is that you wanted to expand the ability of the state, the capacities of the state, to combat poverty, class conflict, immorality, corruption, things of that nature. So progressives tended to, they sort of didn't agree about what to do about those things, but they tended to agree that those things were problems, and that the state needed to act to do something about them. You know, there's a book by Herbert Crowley called The Promise of American Life that kind of lays out a lot of the issues, which is, he says, you know, at one time, inequality, in particular among the free population, although he doesn't say that, but, you know, that's who he's talking about, was much less. You know, you could in one lifetime go from, you know, sort of very little to having a decent sort of, you know, way of life for yourself. You know, you could have a farm, or you could have a, you know, your own shop. If you're a blacksmith or something like this, he says, but with the rise of big business, increasingly that was not the case. You know, either you were born poor or you were born rich. You know, there's a lot of child labor. There are extremely dangerous working conditions, very dirty cities with disease and so forth. And so the reality is there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity. You know, we were becoming a stratified society. We tend to think of that as just the way things always were, but there was a lot of attention at the time to the growth of this stratification that replaced the, you know, because remember, again, wage labor was not the condition of most people until the 20th century. So he thought that, well, what you needed to do, and at the time he was writing, there was this sort of overarching belief that the state should really do very little. And he said there was, he spent a lot of time trying to justify the idea of the state taking action. He didn't say what they should do so much in that book as that it should act. And progressives came up with various solutions to this. You know, there was a general opposition to child labor in favor of, you know, restrictions on child labor, compulsory education laws, also regulation of housing and sanitation, regulation of factory safety. There's a whole area of progressivism that deals with big business and sort of breaking up the trusts, these kind of overarching organizations that would own a significant part of entire industries and sometimes multiple industries. Progressives proposed different solutions to this. You know, some wanted the government to kind of legitimate good trusts and do away with bad trusts, Theodore Roosevelt, for instance. Others, like Woodrow Wilson and Louis Brandeis, wanted to break them up into smaller pieces so they could compete with one another. Progressives also tended to favor electoral reform. And in this area, you know, we tend to be less sympathetic, or depending, you know, some were in favor of literacy tests. Some were in favor of restricting suffrage for African-Americans, including Woodrow Wilson. Others, you know, tended to favor the vote for women. So they, in some ways, wanted to expand the vote, in other ways, wanted to restrict the vote. And this is one of the reasons why it's risky to take progressivism as a sort of historical constant, you know, as a trans-historical concept, because what was progressive or considered progressive at one time, you know, may not be considered progressive today, and it might be considered the opposite. You know, we might think it's you know, anti-progressive or something like this. Right. So they tended to agree about the problems, but not necessarily the solutions.
Right. And you describe several kinds or categories of progressivism. What do you mean by the term national progressivism? And what was this group trying to accomplish?
Well, that's the group that I focus mostly on. I mean, there are progressives who dealt with things like, you know, rural electrification in the West and things like this. But I'm dealing mostly with national policy. So these are progressives who were trying to get the federal government to do things such as break up the trusts or grant new rights to labor unions to organize, you know, who dealt with, you know, the sort of organization of the economy during World War One, you know, trying to find ways to reduce labor conflict or come up with recommendations for how to reduce labor conflict in the long run. Those tend to be, you know, and also, I mean, dealing with during the First World War problems of radical agitation and sort of anti-war sentiment. This is, you know, the propagation of anti-war ideas. This is also something that progressives had to deal with. So by national progressivism, I tend to focus on, yeah, national policy.
Right. And you mentioned earlier that your book, rather than looking at just kind of a generalized group of people that you call progressives, you actually kind of focus on a particular set of characters and kind of look at how their views on various, you know, current events shifted over time. I'm wondering if you could introduce the listeners to some of the characters that you focus on in your book.
Well, I tend to, the idea was we wanted some coverage. You know, progressivism was vast. It incorporated Republicans and Democrats. There were, you know, people all over the country who were involved. But I wanted some sampling, you know, without it being a survey, of, you know, important areas of at least this one sort of element of progressivism. So, for example, you know, I mentioned Jane Addams, who was a Settlement House worker. I also look at Florence Kelly, who was friends with Jane Addams. They worked together. Florence Kelly was a former Marxist who becomes, you know, a very important sort of advocate for factory legislation. And she also lives in settlement houses. And then I deal with sort of journalists. So I have Herbert Croly and Walter Lippmann. They found the New Republic magazine, which becomes a voice for this flavor of progressivism, and, you know, remains a very influential publication for many years. Then I have these sort of labor reformers, Frank Walsh, who was a Kansas City labor lawyer. He becomes the head of the Commission on Industrial Relations, which was this government body appointed by Woodrow Wilson to figure out why there were so many strikes. And during World War I, he's the head of the National War Labor Board, which tries to deal with labor unrest and come up with solutions to it to enable the production of what's needed to fight the First World War. And also Carlton Parker, who is an investigator for the National War Labor Board and for the Commission on Industrial Relations. He's not an investigator for the National War Labor Board. He works for the Cantonment's Adjustment Commission, which is, you know, something that is trying to settle labor conflicts in the Northwest forests. But he worked before that for the Commission on Industrial Relations. He was a labor economist. He had sort of theories about what caused radical agitation, psychological theories of this. Although he was popular among, you know, labor activists as well as progressives. And then there are legal progressives like Felix Frankfurter and Louis Brandeis, who are very important scholars of law as well as, you know, progressive jurisprudence. Louis Brandeis was one of the inventors of the sociological jurisprudence, which is, of course, now very controversial. Again, oddly, but he was one of the, you know, the progenitors of the idea that you have to look at what the impact of the law is, not just the words of the law. And that was very important to the development of factory legislation, hours legislation, really any kind of regulation of business, which until that point was just struck down by the courts. Then, of course, Woodrow Wilson, you know, who was president during World War I. Many of the people that I'm talking about joined the Wilson administration or support it. Walter Lippmann, you know, occupies a position there. George Creel, rather, is another person that comes into this who's actually friends with Frank Walsh, but he becomes the head of the Committee on Public Information during World War I. He was also a Kansas City journalist. But the Committee on Public Information is the U.S. propaganda agency during World War I. I also include a W.E.B. Du Bois, who is a sociologist and is an advocate for Black civil rights. He's actually a supporter of Wilson, oddly, even though Wilson segregates the federal government. I included Helen Keller for the book, who was actually Helen Keller was... I mean, she's sort of remembered as a progressive, but she was really, out of all of the progressives, perhaps the most consistently radical. She actually joins the IWW. I guess I don't need to say who Helen Keller was, because she was, as Mark Twain said, she's one of the most famous people in the history of the world.
I think the inclusion of Helen Keller was interesting to me. Most people know, just going in America, going to grade school, you learn about Helen Keller as, you know, a sort of survivor hero, whatever, who overcame, you know, tremendous physical disabilities to be able to sort of function in society. But what I think most Americans don't know is that she was also a radical, that she was a political radical. And I remember reading the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, and he notes that Helen Keller wrote two books. One book is about sort of overcoming her physical disability, and the other one is her, you know, radical politics, very socialist politics. And essentially, most Americans know all about the first book and have never heard about the second. So I think in that context, it's interesting that you included it. And obviously, you're pointing out that she was a socialist intellectual and activist. And that part, I think, is really unknown to most ordinary Americans.
Yeah, I mean, it was unknown to me until I started. I didn't know the extent of it until I was asked, as part of the revision of the dissertation into a book, to incorporate more characters. And Helen Keller was one of them. I had come across her when I was doing the dissertation, because there was a member of the IWW, Joe Hill, who was convicted of murder under, you know, questionable circumstances. And she actually wrote to Woodrow Wilson asking him to do something about him. It was a state matter, according to Wilson, so he couldn't do anything, although that's sort of questionable. But that's when I first discovered that she was sympathetic to these ideas. But then in writing the book, I found out, yeah, she was not only a socialist, but she actually, as I said earlier, she joined the IWW.
This radical...
the syndicalist labor union that wanted to overthrow capitalism. And she talked about how, you know, one of the things she talked about was how, you know, it's difficult to comprehend, I think, just how bad working conditions were for unskilled workers in the early 20th century. But she talked about, you know, how children were often blinded in industrial accidents and things like this. But she was just generally sympathetic to the disadvantaged. And in her lifetime, people accused her or those around her of kind of brainwashing her. It's interesting, you know. I mean, she's a very intelligent person, you know, very learned, but people would be sort of, you know, suspicious of her radical politics, you know, even though radical politics at the time were not that rare. Nonetheless, there were allegations that she was kind of, you know, misled into these views. She also, yeah, she expressed, you know, it's interesting because before the First World War, progressives generally had a very sympathetic view of Germany, because Germany had this very expansive welfare state. And she remained sympathetic to Germany even after the U.S. enters the war, which didn't help in terms of her, in terms of her political influence. Other progressives kind of dialed that back because they sensed that, you know, this would harm their ability to achieve any influence. And that's an important element of progressivism, this idea of kind of seeking a way of putting things that will articulate with the current sort of, political power establishment. Helen Keller was less determined to do that. I mean, she just kept saying, well, you know, this is the way that things should be. And that itself illustrates something about how progressivism was a little different from radicalism. You know, you don't just keep saying the same thing if that means you're going to get hit over the head.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, Helen Keller herself had what we would consider today a very kind of a very thoughtful understanding of the relationship between her overcoming her physical disabilities and class and economics. And she basically said that, again, like everyone was sort of impressed with her because she was able to overcome, you know, her physical disabilities. And she basically said, yeah, I was able to do that because I came from a very privileged background and my family was able to provide me with, you know, this wonderful, companion, teacher, helper, whatever, who's really able to get through to her and, you know, and help her develop. But that many other people, even people who have, you know, fewer physical disabilities, may not be able to overcome them simply because they don't have these kind of economic advantages that I have because of, you know, the class background that I'm coming from. So like she saw this, you know, very clearly the relationship between her family's economic privilege and her own ability to overcome her physical limitations, but or disabilities. But basically, it seems like the story, the narrative that got developed in America was just, here's this amazing woman, and they kind of chopped away the kind of radical insights that and politics that she promoted.
Yeah, well, and it in other words, makes it a matter of individual achievement rather than, collective, not only in terms of class, but also in terms of getting help from others. It becomes a, you know, purely a matter of individual genius.
Yeah. And I'm curious, you, when I saw that you included W.E.B. Du Bois, this African-American, brilliant scholar, sociologist, activist, that you included him as one of the, quote, progressives, I always think of Du Bois as a socialist, if not later on in life as a communist. And it's interesting that's how you see him earlier on in the 20th century. He lived a very long time.
Yeah.
To like the 1970s.
The 1960s. Yeah. Well, yeah. And actually, I did not include him in the dissertation for that very reason. But Du Bois is important, I think, because he illustrates kind of the pressures to, you know, it's true that he was a lifelong socialist, although, again, before the war, the distinction between progressivism and socialism was much murkier. You know, I don't actually... In the things that he was writing, that at least I consulted, his attitudes toward radicalism, it doesn't seem like he was really that far out of step with other progressives before the war. And even during the war, you know, he issues this very famous, editorial, Close Ranks, which says, you know, we should support the Wilson administration, you know, and defer civil rights issues until later. And I think that he is important for that reason, that he illustrates the pressure to kind of go along with this, with the war effort that helped to kind of create this distinction between progressivism and radicalism during the war. Now, after the war, he becomes more anti-capitalist, and so he continues in a direction that other progressives really don't, or at least in a different way. I mean, because there are arguments, you know, that when you get to the New Deal period, some of these programs are so massive.
1930s.
Yeah, that you know, and when you look at people like Sidney Hillman and others, who himself is a socialist, there are arguments that, you know, that I'm now that I've sort of moved on from the progressive period, I'm sort of forced to grapple with and take a little more seriously, maybe, that, you know, there are elements of social democracy that characterize the 30s. You know, Du Bois moves in a sort of pro-communist direction and comes to oppose capitalism, you know, more completely than did people like, you know, Felix Frankfurt or others. So it's, you know, he goes in a different direction. But I think that, again, the issue is not so much where people are on the spectrum, it's how the whole spectrum moves. And I think you see that movement even with Du Bois as a consequence of the war.
Yeah. Speaking of the war and Du Bois, and the article that of Du Bois that you just mentioned, I was really surprised. You have a line from the article where Du Bois says, essentially to the African American readers of the publication that he's writing for, and he says, first your country, then your rights, meaning that we should really first focus on America winning the war and all that, and then only afterwards will come to deal with the real integration, inclusion, civil rights for African Americans. I think that might come as a surprise to some people today that was the way that Du Bois, the position that he took then during World War II, during World War I.
I think that, Du Bois had kind of a good way of putting things, but it, a sort of clear way of putting things. But he was not alone in viewing it that way, except that the one thing I would say is, when he sort of says your country versus your rights, I don't know that that's exactly how most progressives thought of it. I'm not sure that he necessarily meant, he didn't mean that your rights were less important. I think he thought that in order to accomplish your rights, we were better off participating in this war enthusiastically. And patriotically. But I think for other progressives, part of it was that there were some rights that were being advanced by participation in the war, and some objectives that they had been seeking that were being advanced. So for example, if you look at somebody like Frank Walsh, he draws up this whole plan with all this testimony and, a dozen volumes of testimony and findings about how labor conflict can be reduced. And again, I try to get across in the book just how bad labor problems were. I mean, terrible, rates of infant mortality, just incredibly unsafe and unsanitary conditions, just the worst exploitation of workers by drawing entire families in their thousands for just a few jobs and then paying them pennies. I mean, it just really, really bad. It's hard for us to think of that unless we read about it, vividly. And he made these recommendations for things like labor recognition and limiting of hours and taxation of inheritances to fund public works and public health care, health insurance and unemployment benefits and all these things, many of which get adopted in the 30s, but were sort of impossible to do, in the second decade of the 20th century. But then the war happens and some of these things actually can happen. He's made the head of the National War Labor Board. They investigate 1,100 strikes and, there is pressure for businesses to recognize labor unions. And union leaders thought of this as, a tremendous advance in terms of their rights. Except they didn't necessarily put it in terms of rights. They tended to put it more in terms of, in terms of collective achievement. Sidney Hillman, said that, Messiah, we hear Messiah's footsteps. It was thought to be the accomplishment of these long-sought objectives. And so at the same time, Frank Walsh and others were aware that there was suppression of radicalism and suppression of freedom of speech. And they thought, there's a limit to what can be done about that right now. The way Frank Walsh put it to a conscientious objector was that, some of these things are just going to be swept away, with the tide. And those weren't the exact words he used, but, something to that effect. The emphasis on individual rights becomes more of a focus after the war with the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, and kind of a realignment of progressivism, not as radicalism again, but now as with an emphasis on civil liberties. And a clear distinction, especially during the Red Scare of the 1920s, there is now an insistence among progressives that, well, we are not radicals, but we think radicals deserve to have their rights protected. And that's a different way of putting it than was the case before the war, when the boundary was somewhat permeable. You know, progressives sometimes overlapped with radicals, both in terms of their official affiliations and in terms of what they would say. Du Bois goes in a different direction, you know, after the war. I mean, he becomes more anti-capitalist. He increasingly feels that the root of the problem is itself capitalism. You know, before the war, he tended to blame labor unions for the exclusion of African Americans. After the war, he blames capitalism for segregation, you know, for this, you know, he feels that that's really the root of the problem he follows a little bit of a different trajectory, but that sort of prioritization of, you know, loyalty during the war is quite characteristic of, you know, most of the people in the book, except for Helen Keller, really.
right. Well, I'm curious also, you mentioned that Louis Brandeis, of course, a famous Jewish lawyer and eventually...
Jewish?
Are you telling me every Jewish mother, when she says, you know, you could be like Brandeis, you know, she got it wrong?
Fortunately, I was never told that.
Unfortunately. And of course becomes a Supreme Court justice. So he's included as one of the progressives. And I'm always struck by Brandeis, and you mentioned that one of the key thing that you're looking at is how these progressives, how they think about labor issues and, you know, what rights workers should have in relation to, you know, the rights of business owners and so on, and how to resolve conflicts between workers and big business. And I just find it interesting that Brandeis famously said once that he was, quote, the lawyer for the situation, that he didn't feel that he was representing the interests of big business or the interests of, you know, the workers per se, but he was a lawyer for the situation. He was going to find a way for everyone basically to get along and at least get some of what they wanted. And I always find that particular phrase really fascinating because, you know, with the labor unions, there's a famous labor union song, "Which Side Are You On?" You know, and it's talking about the, especially the unions for the coal miners, and basically saying you're either with the coal miners or you're with, you know, the owners of the coal mines who are exploiting the workers, but you can't be on both sides. And Brandeis is basically saying, in effect, no, you can, that there's a position where the interests of the big business and the labor unions and workers are somehow, could come together. And I just wonder, you know, what does that say about Brandeis's understanding of labor conflict, that you're able to be on both sides somehow and help both sides rather than kind of picking one of the sides, if that makes sense.
Well, I think that's true, that Brandeis had this view of, the public, that, he develops in this, this set of strikes in the garment industry, in 1909, 1910, in New York City, something called the Protocol of Peace, which has this idea that there are three parties. There's business, there's labor, and then there's the public. And I think he viewed himself as a representative of the public. And that pattern of this, what's called tripartitism, you know, business, labor, and the public, that becomes kind of the quintessential progressive and later liberal way of dealing with labor conflict. That's recapitulated in the Commission on Industrial Relations, in the National War Labor Board, and ultimately in the National Labor Relations Act. I mean, first in the National National Recovery Administration, Section 7A in the Great Depression, and then in the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, where there are these three groups that meet and their representatives for each, over time, you know, in particular, you know, one of the things, I mean, during the First World War, there's a lot of pressure to go along with the recommendations of the National War Labor Board, but with the National Labor Relations Act, it becomes compulsory for businesses to negotiate with elected representatives from workers. And then when they reach an agreement, it has the power of law behind it. Early on, you know, the protocol piece is sometimes criticized because it puts in place this dispute settlement procedure that is rather cumbersome. And if, you know, it's not settled in the workers' favor, if it's not settled at all, sometimes they went on strike. And Brandeis was very angry about this. You know, if you went on strike, despite this machinery being in place, he felt that you were, you know, a traitor to the protocol or something like that. So it more or less prohibited strikes. And so the public, you know, being a third party, you know, there is some question of whether or not that was really, you know, in everybody's interest or objective, or, you know, in some feel that it was more like, you know, in many respects, taking the side of business, especially if the if there was no compulsory recognition of unions, which does come with the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act. But it's a very, very important principle, you know, in American labor history, you know, this idea of tripartitism that Brandeis develops.
All right. And so you mentioned that during World War One, essentially, there was a lot of pressure on progressives to get in line with the objectives of the of Roosevelt, of Wilson's administration, and not to encourage or support strikes or labor agitation, because that would make it more difficult for factories to produce the armaments that the American military and its allies needed to carry on the war effort. So then after World War One, we have the Palmer Raids. What were the Palmer Raids, and how did progressives respond to them?
Well, it's interesting, you know, I mean, during the war, I should just say that it's not just that they want to go along with the efforts of winning the war, the, you know, the idea of promoting democracy or a particular kind of democracy, you know, or a particular kind of revolution, which is important to Wilson and also Walter Lippmann. But it's also the progressives put in place these institutions that they wanted to have, and they seem to be threatened by labor conflict. Especially radical labor conflict, you know, espousing the idea of overthrowing capitalism. During World War One, that kind of threatens these institutions. And progressives also have kind of an instinctive sort of aversion to disorder. They like things to be kind of orderly. And that becomes a distinction also between progressives and radicals, because people like Bill Haywood, who was the Secretary Treasurer of the IWW, he was, you know, all in favor of disorder. That was, you know, sort of a good thing. But after the war, you know, what you get is, I mean, there's repression during the war of radicals. That kind of expands in the post-war period, where the Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer, who had been a progressive before, he was opposed to child labor, he had good progressive credentials, he engages in these very wide raids of suspected radicals and communists. The FBI, you know, goes in and arrests people, often who have no connection to anything other than they're teaching in a, you know, a sort of place of where they're Russian immigrants. This is happening after the Russian Revolution. And so there's a lot of, you know, this sort of paranoia of the spread, the possible spread of revolution, and thousands of people are rounded up and in many cases they're rounded up, interrogated, and released. But others are incarcerated or deported. There's a very good book by Chris Capozzola, called Uncle Sam Wants You, which documents the extent of this. It's not just the FBI, or what at this point was called the Bureau of Investigation, but also voluntary groups kind of participate in this, and they expel members and they turn them in. So it's just this very widespread sort of repression. And I think for progressives, they could see, you know, not only now wasn't there the sort of concern about winning the war, because the war's over, or about preserving progressive institutions, because they had already started to become dismantled or were dismantled altogether. But they could also see that it was just overbroad. You know, it's one thing to tolerate repression when it seems to be serving some progressive end, and another thing when people seem to be going haywire. And so there's just this widespread ridicule of Palmer, You know, in the New Republic, you know, Florence Kelly writes a letter where she says he should be sent to, you know, she doesn't name him, but she seems to be talking about Palmer. She says he should be sent to Boreal Galuga or some, you know, imaginary place. And I think it's important because on the one hand, I think that Palmer, he tends to be remembered as kind of a right-wing zealot, but he really wasn't. He was himself a progressive before. He was hoping to run for president. He thought it would be popular to do what he's doing. But also because I think he's a little bit of an easy target, you know. Anti-radicalism and later anti-communism tends to be associated with this, you know, with this irrational overreach of government suppression. But I think it's important to know that, you know, it wasn't always like that. The suppression, this anti-radicalism, you know, during the war, there were, you know, forms of repression that were quite bad and that were taken seriously, not only by Woodrow Wilson, but by others that I've, you know, talked about before, or at least tolerated. And that also come back, you know, that don't really go away. And so, you know, to borrow a term from the scholar of fascism, Robert Paxton, you know, Palmer becomes a bit of an alibi. That comes to represent anti-communism, Palmer, McCarthy, and the other forms of, and also for, you know, people like Walter Lippmann, you know, who were, you know, somewhat tolerant of suppression during the war. He becomes kind of a, you know, not a straw man because he's not fake. He's not imaginary, but a, you know, an alibi. We're not like that, you know. And I think that leaves out, you know, the very real sympathy for suppression that was an important element of progressivism and which comes back, you know, which is a thing the state can now do. The clear and present danger doctrine, which was written by, you know, Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes, that decision, that becomes, you know, a sort of permanent thing. I mean, now, you know, we're using it for the documents that were at Mar-a-Lago, you know, the Espionage Act is being invoked again. So it's for better or worse.
Right, right. Well, there's so much more to talk about your book, but we are going to run out of time. So I'll leave you with one last question. What do you hope readers take away from your book?
Well, first of all, I hope they take away the book and buy it. But,
so this is not a steal this book, no. You know, Abby Hoffman. Okay. At least we're clear about that. All right.
I mean, the main thing is that I want them to know that, you know, progressivism kind of embraced these ideas of radicalism earlier, but that progressivism wasn't perfect and that it didn't always mean what we want it to have meant, that it's important to grapple with the limitations of progressivism, you know, in terms of suppression of radicalism, in terms of suppression of free expression, in terms of acceptance of segregation. You know, these ideas now tend to be thought of as anti-progressive. But in reality, you know, progressives had both good and bad things that we tend not to associate with progressivism anymore, but that we should remember because they continue to have an influence on the way that the state is configured and the way the politics play out in the present.
Right. Well, that's definitely something worth remembering and thinking about. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.